and Nipah is also quite deadly. It causes outbreaks every few years in Bangladesh. So Oliver went there in 2010 and captured a bunch of bats. Many had signs of Nipah in their blood. Others had something surprising.
There's antibodies to something related to Ebola Zaire.
Ebola Zaire is the type of virus spreading around West Africa right now. It's also the most deadly form of Ebola. Until this discovery, scientists thought Ebola Zaire was found only in Africa. Now they've found signs of it in Bangladesh and China.
If you think about geographic space, it was a big shock to find, you know, evidence for this virus in a very faraway place in South Asia.
Does that make you think that Ebola could emerge in Bangladesh?
Well, that's a tricky one. I think if you have the right, you know, combination of potential events and a sort of the perfect storm brews, then yeah, it's possible.
Oliver is working with USAID to build an Ebola early warning system around the world. Now, there's no sign bats have infected people in Asia yet. And David Heyman says it's actually quite rare for bats to pass Ebola onto people.
There's an enormous amount of human bat contact in generally. And, you know, in a way, maybe we should question why there have been so few outbreaks.
Still, these ecologists say it's not whether a virus in the Ebola family will cause an outbreak outside of Africa, but a matter of when and where. Mikeline Duclef, NPR News.
In the city of Cleveland, the investigation into the police shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice continues this new year. No criminal charges have been filed, and now city officials tell NPR they are in talks to hand over the investigation to the county sheriff's department. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports.
While no final decision has been announced, a city spokesman tells NPR that Cleveland officials want an outside agency to handle all of its deadly use of force cases involving police. Calls for an outside agency to take over the investigation into Tamir Rice's death began last November. Tamir was reaching for a toy gun in a playground when he was shot by a Cleveland police officer. The day after the autopsy report was released, his mother, Samaria Rice, spoke at a Washington rally protesting the deaths of black males at the hands of police.
My son was 12 years old, just a baby, my baby, the youngest out of four.
Tamir's death came as the U.S. Department of Justice was concluding an unrelated civil rights investigation into Cleveland's police department. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the results just weeks after the incident.
We have determined that there is reasonable cause to believe that the Cleveland Division of Public Police engages in a pattern and practice of using excessive force.
For now, the city of Cleveland is still in charge of collecting evidence. If the county does take over this case, it would be the second high-profile killing involving Cleveland police to be investigated by an outside agency in 2 years. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
New Year's Day was a day of transitions. Andrew Cuomo took the oath of office for a second term as governor of New York.
And his father, former Governor Mario Cuomo, died at age 82. There is no better way to remember Cuomo than to listen to the sound of his voice.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the great Empire State and the whole family of New York, let me thank you for the great privilege of being able to address this convention.
It was the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco, and Democrats were challenging President Ronald Reagan, who had spoken of America as a shining city on a hill.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. A shining city is perhaps all the president sees from the portico of the White House and the veranda of his ranch, where everyone seems to be doing well. But there's another city. There's another part to the shining city, the part where some people can't pay their mortgages, and most young people can't afford one, where students can't afford the education they need, and middle-class parents watch the dreams they hold for their children evaporate.
Cuomo was speaking in support of Democratic presidential nominee Walter Mondale. For the record, Mondale was utterly crushed that fall in one of the most overwhelming landslides in American history.
But Democrats took note of Cuomo's eloquence. They soon spoke of him as a presidential prospect.
Might have known better. Immediately after that 1984 speech, Cuomo caught a plane back to New York. He could rarely stand to leave his home state. That's how New York he was.
And when his chance came to step on the national stage for the 1992 presidential election, Cuomo chose not to run. That cleared the way for another Democrat, and Cuomo spoke in support of him at the Democratic convention.
Prayer is always a good idea, but our prayers must be accompanied by good works,
We need a captain who understands that and who will seize the wheel before it's too late. I am here tonight to offer America that new captain with a new course before it is too late. And he is Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas.
Bill Clinton won that election, but Democrats then suffered devastating losses in 1994. The losers included Mario Cuomo, defeated for re-election.
In later years, the ex-governor turned to writing. He wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln and came on this program to talk about it. We had a little argument that showed Cuomo's mind at work. President Lincoln never professed to belong to an organized church
absolutely.
Of any kind.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely accurate. And if he was anything, he was a rationalist.
And yet, even though he did not belong to an organized religion, Lincoln often did invoke God in his speeches and used the language of the Bible in his speeches, which is a way that he's like modern politicians, isn't he?
He used the language of the Bible over and over in the second inaugural, how religious his references are. And yeah, that's absolutely true. But he never talks about Jesus as God. And he doesn't talk about God. He talks about creator. He was clearly not a person who accepted any specific religious faith.
In the second inaugural, there's the line about, as God gives us to see the right. I mean, there are references to God.
Yeah, well, yes, but he never makes an argument for God.
I just wonder if it says something about the electorate that politicians were addressing then and now.
Well,
something practical.
Well, let me ask a really grubby political question. I'm better at this than you are because I lived that life for a long time. Would a politician stoop so low as to use religion to get close to voters? Yeah, I hope I didn't do it too much, because when I drop dead and I find out there is a God, and indeed he has a big book with everything noted, yeah, of course politicians do it. Did Lincoln do it for that reason? All I know is Lincoln was a master politician.
The late Mario Cuomo's career as a politician was pragmatic. Behind the soaring rhetoric was a governor who was often centrist, managing New York's slow recovery from the economic disasters of the 1970s. He worked on the pragmatic details of governing his state and his shining city. This is NPR News.
It's 8:18. We're glad you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Crimea is under Russian rule, and people there are grappling with a number of problems, such as power blackouts and even banking issues. Coming up at 8:33, an update on the situation in Crimea 9 months after the Russian takeover. It'll be sunny in Wisconsin today, with most highs in the low to mid-20s.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
Artists present their view of household objects. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support Wisconsin artists. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In the Java Sea, the search continues for bodies and wreckage of AirAsia Flight 8501. At least a dozen bodies have been retrieved so far. That's up to 30 now. But Michael Sullivan tells us rescuers are racing the clock.
The longer it takes, the harder it'll get to find what they're looking for. The wreckage can be carried by the current and dispersed. And the longer the bodies of the passengers and the crew stay in the water, the more they'll decompose, which will make it harder to find and identify them. But authorities continue to express optimism about finding the fuselage and the black boxes, or flight data and cockpit voice recorders, in the next couple days.
Correspondent Michael Sullivan. Another abandoned cargo ship loaded with migrants is to arrive today at a port in Italy. More than 400, mostly Syrians,
are aboard. European stock markets slipped on the first day of 2015 trading. Worries about recovery in the eurozone, falling oil prices, and the upcoming election in Greece were a drag. Meanwhile, Latvia is poised to take over leadership of the European Union. NPR's Corey Flintoff explains.
The smaller countries in Europe really need to be part of a big trading bloc if they're going to succeed. So Latvia has a big stake in trying to revive the European Union's economy. Latvia's prime minister is pledging to implement a $380 billion investment plan to try to get the economy growing again.
I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. A suburban Milwaukee lawmaker is considering a plan to have somebody else take over the city's lowest performing public schools, either the state or charter school operators. Senator Alberta Darling's office confirms it's talking to affected parties about a possible state-run or so-called recovery school district. The proposal has not been finalized, but members of the Milwaukee Teachers Union are already trying to fight it. The district is not commenting on possible legislative ideas. A spokesman says officials are working on improving the city's 14 lowest-performing schools. You can expect a price change for vaccinations at Wisconsin public health facilities in the new year. The Badger Care Health Program now requires a top fee of $20 for things like the MMR measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Families who cannot pay will get their fees waived. Melvin Gordon's final college football game was a great one. He ran for an Outback Bowl record 251 yards and three touchdowns as Wisconsin upset Auburn 34-31 in overtime. Gordon won the game's most valuable player award with his 34 carries. He ended the season with 2,587 yards. That's just 41 yards short of the FBS single-season rushing record. The 17th-ranked Badgers end the season with 11 wins and 3 losses. Incoming coach Paul Christ watched the game from the stands. He'll take over next season. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org. From A. Mark Foundation, supporting procon.org, a nonprofit educational website examining the pros and cons of controversial issues for students, teachers, and the public. Available online at procon.org. From Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors, on the web at pamm.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The world looks different from the Arabian Peninsula. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah was admitted to the hospital this week. He's in his 90s, older than Saudi Arabia itself. The country is a huge U.S. ally. The king's ailment raises the question of succession. Journalist and longtime Saudi watcher Thomas Lipman says that is just one of the kingdom's challenges.
In general, when princes of that level or kings have something that's serious but not immediately threatening, where they go is the airport. And they go to the Cleveland Clinic, or they go at least to Geneva or something like that. In this case, they felt the need to hospitalize him right there in Riyadh. He's at the National Guard Hospital, which may indicate either that it's just tests, which is what the official announcement said, or that it's something that was immediately life-threatening.
Has the king in his 90s actually been the person who's been running Saudi Arabia?
Well, yes, he has. The king is also the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And he just did a cabinet shakeup. He appointed 6 or 7 new cabinet ministers just last month. I don't know how many hours a day he's able to focus on business, but he's the boss.
And is there a transition plan in place in the event of his death?
There is, which he created. He put in place maybe 6 years ago a succession law, generally referred to as the allegiance law, which created a committee of 35 senior princes whose job it is to manage the succession.
Does it appear to you that this is a stable government that is in a situation where it can manage a transition to a new
Absolutely.
King?
Absolutely. Right now, the House of Saud is in good standing because when you go to Saudi Arabia and you see the people look around them in every direction, they see violence and chaos. Syria, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Egypt. Bahrain, and they don't see trouble in Saudi Arabia, except among the Shia minority.
It's a majority Sunni country, we should say.
Correct.
So you see here a country with a stable plan for its immediate governing future, and yet you're the author of a book called Saudi Arabia on the Edge, The Uncertain Future of an American Ally. Right. What's uncertain?
Well, inherently, there's the question of how long any monarchical regime that rules entirely from the top down can survive. The future is also uncertain because of energy. They consume so much of their own oil that they're reducing their own capacity to export.
Oh, it's one of those countries that produces a lot of oil, so they sell it to their own people very cheaply, so they don't use it efficiently
they
at all.
They do, and they burn extraordinary amounts of oil to generate electricity, of which Saudi Arabia is a voracious consumer, partly for air conditioning, partly because everyone has every electronic device known to man, and partly because the electricity is used to power the desalination plants, which is the source of drinking water for now almost 30 million people.
The drop in oil prices this year has brought the Russian economy to the brink of collapse. What about the Saudi economy?
Well, funny you should ask. I brought with me the finance ministry statement issued on Christmas Day introducing the budget for the coming year.
Okay.
And it projects a deficit of $14.4 billion. What it says about each category of spending, education, health and social affairs, municipal services, infrastructure, is that spending will continue at the planned levels and they'll just eat the deficit because they have such deep reserves that they don't need to worry about it.
So I guess we get an explanation here about why the Saudis have been willing this year to keep their production high, which keeps oil prices low. They can pursue their own strategic goals there and not worry about the near term.
And if it happens to inflict damage on Iran and Russia, so much the better.
Okay, that raises another question. You said Iran. The Saudis and Iran have a kind of rivalry across the Persian Gulf. Is that a source of uncertainty for the Saudi kingdom?
You know, they moved troops up to the northwestern border to make sure that there would be no attack by the Islamic State militants coming out of Iraq. But what ordinary people, very educated people, are worried about is three things: Iran, Iran, and Iran. It's partly the historic rivalry between Arabs and Persians. It's partly the historic rivalry between Sunni and Shia. And it's partly because of Iranian behavior, which the Saudis see all around them. They see Iranian troublemaking in Yemen in support for the Houthi rebels, in Bahrain in support for the majority Shia dissidents, in Lebanon with support for Hezbollah, and in Syria, where Iran is the mainstay of the Assad government. And, of course, in Iraq, which they think we handed to the Iranians when we got rid of Saddam Hussein. That's a lot of encirclement by a country that they believe is historically, traditionally, and religiously hostile.
What are Saudis thinking as their vital ally, the United States, tries to make a nuclear deal with Iran?
From the Saudi perspective, they lose either way: success in the negotiations or failure in the negotiations. Success in the negotiations brings a really bad outcome: restoration of the Iranian-U.S. de facto alliance that existed in the time of the Shah.
In the 70s, sure.
Inevitably, to the Saudi detriment. They see this as a zero-sum game. On the other hand, if the negotiations fail, what they see happening is the triumph in Iran of the hardliners and a truculent response from Iran and an acceleration of the campaign to get a nuclear weapon.
In an interview broadcast this week on NPR, President Obama spoke about Iran in ways that were seen as very optimistic or generous, and he spoke of the possibility that if Iran just makes a nuclear deal, they could emerge as a very successful regional power. That's a quote. What do Saudis think of Iran as a very successful regional power?
Well, I don't know how they responded to that particular interview. I was struck by the word successful. But if your view is that Iran is a de facto threat, and remember, the Saudis see themselves as locked in a worldwide struggle with Iran for supremacy in Islam.
One predominantly Sunni country, one predominantly Shia country.
Right. And so what you and I might think of as a beneficial outcome to Saudi Arabia and the whole Arab side of the Gulf, i.e. an Iran fully engaged with the world, sort of a new Turkey, that might look very good. It doesn't look appealing to them.
Thomas Lipman, journalist and consultant. His latest book is Saudi Arabia on the Edge, The Uncertain Future of an American Ally. It's NPR News.
Trouble with the feds? Meet Doug Williams. He teaches people how to beat polygraphs.
I'm the only licensed polygraph examiner to ever tell the truth about the so-called lie detector. A polygraph is not a lie detector.
Now Williams faces trial for witness tampering. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm David Green. A few weeks ago in Oregon, Roy Dufek sold his girlfriend's mattress. What he didn't know is that her cat, Camo, was hiding in the box spring. Off went the mattress and Camo, strapped on top of the buyer's car. Mr. Dufek launched a search for Camo using social media. The cat was spotted near an airport outside Portland. He was a little roughed up and had to be lured with sardines and familiar-smelling clothing, but he's now back home, we hope, snuggling into that new bed. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. We invite you to join us Monday morning at 11 on WPR for the inauguration of Governor Scott Walker. It comes to you live from the Wisconsin State Capitol Rotunda. We'll hear the governor, lieutenant governor, and other elected officials take their oaths of office. The program is hosted by Wisconsin Public Television's Zach Schultz and WPR's Sean Johnson. That's the inauguration of Governor Walker Monday morning at 11 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from our contributing members, including the growing number of sustaining members who make ongoing monthly gifts. Thanks to your reliable support, thoughtful programs have a secure home on WPR. Thank you.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Indispensable and in demand. Be that person with an administrative professional degree. Classroom and real-world experience. Learn online or in the classroom. Median starting salary, $31,000. Information at gtc.edu.
For our first Wisconsin Classical Program of 2015, we'll be listening to vocal music of the 16th century. From last summer's Madison Early Music Festival, enjoy the closing concert of Italian Renaissance melodies this Sunday at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
The weather in Wisconsin today will be mostly sunny with afternoon highs mainly in the low to mid-20s. A few more clouds tonight and a chance of snow in the south and east with lows in the teens. Snow is likely in the southeast tomorrow, also a chance of light freezing drizzle with highs near 30. It'll get much colder after that. By Monday, we expect highs from 5 below zero to 3 above.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. And from Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change.
On the first Friday of the year, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. In his New Year's address, Russian President Vladimir Putin celebrated what he called a milestone in 2014, the annexation of Crimea. Western countries were furious that Russia grabbed that piece of Ukraine. And when we went to Crimea to report a few months ago, we found a place where beneath the headlines about Russian aggression and changing borders, lives were left in limbo. And that remains the case. Even though Russia runs the government, Ukraine still controls the power, and they began cutting off electricity last week. We reached Yevgenia Novitskaya, who served as our interpreter in Crimea. She told us that during the blackouts, she gets by using candles and
movies downloaded to the laptop to watch with my son when it is too dark to do anything else.
Now, Russian officials, she said, have promised to end the dependence on Ukraine and to provide Crimea with full power by 2017. But it's not just power.
The Visa and MasterCard credit cards are not working. They are blocked. You cannot use your money. You cannot even cash out your money.
And last week, Ukraine cut train service to Crimea. Yevgenia was planning to visit her sister in Kiev, who's about to have a baby. But now
I don't know how to get there.
And since Crimea came under Russian rule, Yevgenia has lost a lot of work.
I'm an interpreter and translator, so I used to work with international companies. I mean, international projects with foreign people, and now some people think that we don't need foreign languages anymore because we're in Russia.
Who is coming to Crimea? Are there tourists who are coming still?
Now, Crimea is full of government officials on business trips. As for tourism, there is tourism, but it's oriented on Russian market. In Soviet Union times, Crimea used to be main health resort of the whole USSR. Even now, there are a lot of elder people who used to travel to Crimea when they were young. So they just want to come back to USSR, so to say.
But the currency exchange, I mean, the ruble, which is now the currency there, has just taken a nosedive and dropped in value. Does that mean that even pensioners might not be happy at some point soon?
Yeah, so the majority of all the goods and products here in Crimea, they are imported, and the price is directly influenced by the exchange rate. In the morning, you are buying something with this price. In a couple of hours, it will be twice more.
So are you sensing a change in opinion in Crimea because of this? Are people starting to get more frustrated with this transformation this year?
Yes and no. I mean, there are several types of Crimeans. Some of them who are absolutely unhappy with what is going on. The majority of them left Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are like, we are ready to suffer and we're ready to feel whatever it takes, but we're in Russia. Thanks God we're home.
Jenna, what about your level of happiness? When we spoke a few months ago, you said you had lived through so many changes. I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union and then living as part of independent Ukraine and now another change. You were ready to live as a single mom with your son and give it time and just sort of get by as best you could. Is that what you're feeling still today?
What else can I do? I used to work for international companies, but now I need to find something else to survive.
What about the option of just moving to Kiev, like your sister?
If things are the same, I think I will move. But I don't want to. I want to stay in Crimea because I'm Crimean. You know, I traveled to Kiev and I spent there 1 week, and I was trying just to feel like I'm living here. How do I feel? And it's not my place.
Yevgenia Novitskaya spoke to us from her home in the city of Simferopol.
If you are one of the many Americans who resolved to spend more time at the gym in 2015, we have a little extra inspiration to help you stick with your new workout plan.
Let's get physical. I want to get physical. Let's get into physical. Let me hear your body.
That, of course, is the 1980s workout track Physical by Olivia Newton-John. A couple of years ago, we started compiling our ultimate NPR workout mix, a playlist designed to get your body moving. Olivia Newton-John was the first person we asked to tell us what tracks inspire her to get up and move.
One is Rolling Stones' Brown Sugar. Always love that. Every time that comes on in a club, I have to get up.
Brown Sugar.
We went on to hear from all sorts of people about the music that makes them move. Among them, First Lady Michelle Obama, Olympic figure skater Michelle Kwan, tennis stars the Bryan Brothers, the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, and a mailman in Florida. Maroon 5's Moves Like Jagger was the workout track picked by Lieutenant Colonel Cheryl Dacey.
When we spoke with her in May of 2012, she was stationed at Fort Irwin in the Mojave Desert, and she was preparing to deploy to Afghanistan as an Army nurse.
I think music is vitally important for training. It allows me to put my mind somewhere else off of sometimes the physical pain or discomfort or ache or just boredom.
Exercising is not optional for Lieutenant Colonel Dacey. Like everybody else in the Army, she has to pass an annual physical fitness test or face a discharge.
It's a job requirement. It's a condition of employment. You can't just say, oh, well, today I'm tired. I really don't feel like going to the gym. you realize that you have to go and you have to maintain that level of physical readiness.
Dacey prefers training mostly inside, doing sit-ups, lifting upper body weights, pedaling on the stationary bike, and jogging on the treadmill. And what are the other songs that get her moving?
I like Garth Brooks' Calling Baton Rouge.
And one final pick, a classic. That's December 1963, better known as Oh What a Night, from Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Lieutenant Colonel Cheryl Dacey's last pick for the ultimate NPR workout mix.
And now we would like to hear from you. So tweet us what songs will help you get moving in 2015. You can tweet us at Morning Edition.
Playing all the hits, it's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:41. That means the Marketplace Morning Report is coming up in 10 minutes. After a temporary tax increase, the state of Illinois is looking elsewhere to tackle its financial problems in the new year. We'll tell you more about that. Our weather forecast for Wisconsin today, mostly sunny skies with afternoon highs, mainly in the low to mid-20s. A pretty good chance of snow in the south and east tonight and tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we start 2015, we'd like to thank the 50,000 individuals and families who gave to WPR in the past year. The programs that you and your entire community turn to for the best news coverage around, inspiring music, important discussions, great interviews, and entertainment, they're possible because of your support. Thank you, and we look forward to serving you in 2015.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Two of the three Al Jazeera journalists who've been detained in Egypt are seeking to be deported, including Australian journalist Peter Gresta. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says she's hoping a new Egyptian law will pave the way for the move.
So, as I understand it, the law would operate such that he would come back to Australia to face legal proceedings in Australia. If he were still a convicted person under this new law, he would have to come back to face the same sentence.
An Egyptian appeals court this week ordered the retrial of the three Al Jazeera journalists. Alabama coach Nick Saban was on the losing side of a match with the Ohio State Buckeyes at the Sugar Bowl Thursday.
We were up 21-6 because of two turnovers and two stops in the red area. So we really weren't stopping them. We kind of had the momentum of the game because of the turnovers that we got and converted those into scores.
The final score was 42-35. Ohio will play the Oregon Ducks, who ended Florida State season in a 59-20 victory at the Rose Bowl. General Motors is recalling 92,000 full-size trucks and SUVs for a defect in ignition lock systems that can cause safety problems in hot conditions. Certain 2011-2012 models and 2007-14 models are involved. Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is scheduled to visit Milwaukee this afternoon and tonight to support those protesting the lack of charges in the police shooting of Dontre Hamilton. Jackson has a news conference scheduled for 3:30 at Milwaukee's federal courthouse. He'll then lead marchers to Red Arrow Park, where white officer Christopher Manny shot the African-American Hamilton to death last April. Jackson will speak at a Milwaukee church tonight. He's promised to support those who want a federal investigation into basic Milwaukee police patterns and practices. The Justice Department is already investigating whether Hamilton's civil rights were violated. Yesterday, dozens of police supporters rallied along Highway 100 near the Mayfair Mall in suburban Wauwatosa. Hamilton supporters gathered at the same time at one point. Both groups were peaceful. One of the first people charged under Wisconsin's new revenge porn law is scheduled to go on trial next week in Milwaukee. Creslin Jean-Jacques is accused of posting nude and semi-nude photos of his ex-girlfriend on the internet to get back at her during a breakup. Wisconsin's law specifically prohibits a private representation without consent of the person photographed. Ice fishing is going strong in northern Wisconsin, where this week's cold snap drove temperatures to as low as 22 below in Tomahawk. The Department of Natural Resources says milder conditions in the south have resulted in inconsistent ice. For the third year in a row, the DNR is offering a free ice fishing weekend on January 17th and 18th. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate high school prepared for success in college and career. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Green Bay Packer game days are arguably one of the most holy days on the calendar in Wisconsin. At least that's how it played out in Julie Buckle's household, where family brought the football together like little else could.
Growing up, my family dabbled in religion, trying on Lutheran for its location and the Methodist for the personality of its preacher. But in the end, we settled on the Green Bay Packers. Following the tenets of the green and gold had incredible benefits. For one, we didn't have to leave the house, and the couch or carpeted floor was far more comfortable than any pew, padded or not. Secondly, services began in the fall and ended around Christmas, and if we were good, went on into January. Thirdly, popcorn was always served, and we could talk, scream, and laugh during the sermon. Dress was casual. For most of my youth, we had a black and white postage stamp sized television set. No TiVo, Blu-ray, HDTV, 3D, or even VCR. Just rabbit ears that meant most games began with Dad on the roof, Mom at the television set, and one of us kids screaming out the window to go right or left until the picture straightened itself out. So apparently, we had the finest TV in the family because many of my relatives would drive to our house, drink beer or Mountain Dew, eat popcorn, and shout at the screen. This was the 1970s. I was branded a bit of a black sheep from the get-go. I typically lay in the back of the room during games, for sure grateful to be there versus any pew, and read books or took a nap. But then I grew, moved away, and continued to read my way through Sundays. Flying home for Christmas one year, Mom offered a ticket to a live Packer game. My 20-year-old brother, Link, picked me up at the airport December 20th, 1992, and together we drove to frozen Lambeau Field to watch the Packers play the L.A. Rams. Little did I know that 1992 was a watershed year for the Pack. A young quarterback named Brett Favre had replaced an injured Don Magic Mikowski in the third game of that season, and Mike Holmgren had just begun as coach. I wore black leather Doc Martens on my feet. Fashionable on the streets of London, ill-advised on the snowy pavement in Green Bay. I also wore a man's wool overcoat, again youthful fashion over function, black driving gloves, and no hat. We tailgated in the parking lot of Lambeau Field, Mom, Dad, Link, and I, grilling four special exports, two cotton socks, and three bratwurst. Two guys tailgating next to us took such pity on me that they handed over blaze orange gloves, scarves, and a hat. My mom supplied a few more Packer scarves. It was 20 below zero. I haven't had a television for more than 20 years and have judged the season's successes or losses based on the mood of my family. Then this year, I was offered tickets and so decided to take my husband and two children to experience Lambeau. Mom and Dad came, and so did my sister and her family. The weather was balmy, the mood jubilant. As I sat on an aluminum bench, the sun on my face, as an inebriated man dribbled beer down my back, I thought, it sure felt good to be back in church again.
Julie Buckles lives in Ashland. She's the author of Paddling to Winter. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins starts at 9 o'clock. Today's highlights include the children's story, Peter and the Wolf. There are also a couple of solo piano pieces and a guitar concerto. The classical music begins right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
Family's future without him. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support local theater productions. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Our weather in Wisconsin today, mostly sunny. We expect afternoon highs for the most part in the low to mid-20s. A few more clouds tonight and the chance of snow in the south and east with most lows in the teens. Tomorrow should be cloudy and mild with snow likely in the south and east. Maybe, too, a chance of light freezing drizzle. Get colder early next week. Monday, we expect afternoon highs from 5 below 0 to 3 above.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Epic, Mineral Point Chamber of Commerce, and Boswell Book Company, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at VeroInternationalCuisine.com.
The Great Foreign Currency Shift of 2015.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The European single currency is down sharply today. Just over $1.20 will buy a euro. Market players are figuring interest rates in Europe will stay lower longer, following hints from the head of the European Central Bank today about the possibility of new stimulus. On Fridays, we consult Christopher Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial in New York. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, David. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. It was suggested to me today that sometime this year, in 2015, we could see the euro and the dollar at parity. A dollar would buy a euro. Is that crazy?
It is crazy, and it's also entirely possible. We had a 20% move in the dollar against the euro in 2014. Why not 2015? Interest rates are expected to remain crazy low in Europe for a long time. They're expected to rise here. And what that does is it attracts capital out of Europe into the U.S. In other words, people sell euros and buy dollars.
So U.S. goods would get more expensive to sell overseas. That might hurt U.S. factory workers. Foreign profits, if you sold something in Europe, won't turn into as many U.S. dollars when you bring the money back to the U.S. But I suppose if you're thinking about a vacation to Europe, right?
Well, no, that's exactly right. It's the best time for a vacation in Europe since the mid-80s. So it has been a pretty sharp reversal. As far as the U.S. economy goes, you're right, it hurts U.S. manufacturing. But remember, we are primarily a consumer economy. When the dollar's strong, it means foreign goods are cheaper and consumers benefit. So it's not necessarily all bad for us either.
Christopher Lowe at FTN Financial, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's do the numbers. After the sharp drop in stock prices on New Year's Eve, it is a new day. The Dow's up 127 points, 0.7%, 17,950 there. The S&P 500 up 0.6%, a similar percentage rise for the NASDAQ. In a few minutes, the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas will have a report on U.S. manufacturing. When the movie Selma goes into wide release next Friday, the speeches given by the actor playing Martin Luther King in the film will not be historically accurate. The studio did not have the rights to use Dr. King's actual words because of rights issues. Those rights had already been sold to a rival film studio, DreamWorks, and a deal's a deal. The King estate is known for keeping tight control over Dr. King's intellectual property, but when it comes to the online world, that's not always easy. Marketplace's David Weinberg wanted to know more about an oddly incongruous ad that popped up when he tried to watch one of Dr. King's most famous speeches online.
Given the tight control over Dr. King's intellectual property, I was surprised to find the I Have a Dream speech in its entirety on YouTube. but when I pressed play, a white guy ate a tortilla chip and then took off his clothes to reveal a sumo wrestling loincloth. It's a Doritos commercial. Ads are common on YouTube. But what did surprise me was who posted the video, a user named SullenToys.com, a website run by a guy who collects dolls, zombie dolls. I asked copyright expert Jennifer Jenkins to help me understand why the King Estate allowed a guy who collects zombie dolls to show ads on a video he doesn't own.
Probably when you see an ad like this, what's happening is it's YouTube's content ID system.
Under that system, the holder of copyright can block an unauthorized video, or it can collect all the ad revenue, which apparently is the option chosen by the King Estate and Sony, which co-owns the rights to the I Have a Dream speech. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Angie's List, providing online access to reviews of local companies and helping consumers achieve their home improvement goals, from remodeled kitchens to freshly painted houses to new landscapes. Angie'sList.com. And by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We are so predictable sometimes. What am I doing now that it's the new year? Using a nifty app to count calories. Others are hitting the gym for the first time since the Great Flood. You know why you don't go to the gym enough? Quasi-hyperbolic discounting. Annie Baxter explains.
Every new year, Janelle Farrell vows to attack the same two goals.
It's always fitness, and then the other thing is to chew my food slower.
The local YWCA probably won't help her chew her food, but Farrell hopes it will help her get buff. Farrell recently stopped by the Y in St. Paul, Minnesota to learn about memberships.
Oh, yeah.
And test out the leg press.
Yeah, I need to be lifting weights.
Farrell also takes yoga and kickboxing classes at a couple other places. But she says this is Minnesota. It's really cold in the winter. She sometimes has a hard time getting out of the house to do anything.
Those are bad weeks. I don't feel good.
For many of us, those bad weeks last for months. To explain why we struggle to get ourselves to the gym, economists tend to throw around some fancy terms like present bias or
quasi-hyperbolic discounting, sometimes also known as the beta-delta model.
Dan Ackland is a behavioral economist at the University of California, Berkeley. He says those complicated terms come down to this. When we consider whether to hit the gym, the payoff might seem too remote. Instead, we focus on the immediate barriers.
The cost of getting out of bed, the cost of taking the time to drive to the gym and so forth, weighs more heavily than the long-term health benefits.
Ackland says when people sign up for a gym, they're often overly optimistic that all those barriers will magically disappear.
So we say that they are naive with respect to their future self-control problems.
The result is that about half the people with health club memberships are no-shows. That's according to Justin Sidnor, an economist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says a lot of people think that the money they spend on gym memberships will push them to exercise more. But Sidnor says the gym might be part of the problem.
Is the gym the easiest place? Is it the place that you're not going to struggle as much on a daily basis to go to?
Sidnor says the important thing for New Year's fitness resolutions is to avoid setting lofty goals that will be really hard to meet. Start with something simple, he says. Even if that's just taking a walk. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
And Macau, just across from Hong Kong, is the spot for gambling in Asia. But there is news today that gambling revenue there dropped by nearly a third over the last year. Chinese tycoons are gambling less, trying to keep their heads down amid a crackdown on corruption. If you miss our coverage of this on the air, it'll be in the Marketplace Midday podcast. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio, where there is news for you tomorrow and Sunday as well, with Weekend Edition and Weekend All Things Considered on both days. Or you can find news and feature stories anytime at WPR.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Attention all Facebook users, you're invited to click like WGTD for breaking news, photos, stage and program information, links to archives, and to interact with WGTD employees and listeners. The page is available to non-Facebook subscribers as well. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.